I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Last year, there were 562 murders in Philadelphia. And if the rate of homicides continues this year, we will break that number by the end of 2022. While those deaths are tragic and shocking, more than 1,300 people have been injured in shootings this year, leaving city residents fearful and frustrated and angry at this disturbing level of violence, particularly those living in hard-hit neighborhoods. Now, the police have gotten more money from city government to address the problem, which has also earmarked more than $200 million for programs to combat this crisis. Today on Radio Times, we look at the root of this crisis, the root causes of this epidemic of gun violence in Philadelphia, which solutions show promise, what this level of bloodshed says about the city, what can be done to improve police-community relations, how to help traumatized residents and young people at risk. Clearly a lot to talk about. And we have three guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studios is Kendra Vandewater. She is executive director, co-founder of Yeah Philly, working with young people to reduce gun violence. And Kendra, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me back.
You're very welcome. Also with us here in our Philadelphia studios is Sammy Keola. She is gun violence prevention reporter for WHYY. Sammy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us from Princeton is Patrick Sharkey. He's a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, wrote a book back in 2018 titled Uneasy Peace. Patrick Sharkey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Nice to have all three of you with us. I have kind of a broad-based question to get us started. And I was thinking about the war in Ukraine, the level of death and devastation that we see and we read about and we hear about. Should we think, and I'll put this to you, Kendra, first, should we think of some neighborhoods in Philadelphia as war zones? Is that helpful?
Absolutely. I mean, I live in a war zone. I live in West Philly by 60th Street. I consider it a war zone, but there are a lot of neighborhoods that have a lot of disinvestment, and they should be considered war zones. And it was written about maybe last year, considering about the 57 blocks where most of the crime has happened since 2015, and they are all definitely war zones.
Sammy, you've talked to a lot of residents living in some of these neighborhoods. What did they tell you?
That they really, really don't feel safe. You know, what Kendra's describing, a daily fear of walking down the street. People don't want to sit on their porches. They're afraid to go to the store. Even sitting in your house can be a danger. We've seen bullets go through people's windows. We've seen bullets go into recreation centers and libraries and places that used to feel like safe havens, and they're not. So it's a daily worry.
So fear, I mean, the sort of pall of fear over the city, would you say, or over certain neighborhoods?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think we don't think enough about the toll that takes mentally, emotionally on people that are living in toxic stress and also frustration and anger.
I want to pick up on all of that. Patrick, let me get you in on the conversation. Philadelphia is not the only city dealing with this level of gun violence. It's not new, but it certainly has been on the increase in the last couple of years. What's driving it, do you think?
Well, the big increase started in 2020, and, you know, 2020 was a chaotic and terrible year for a lot of reasons, and a lot of things changed. You know, public space changed. More people bought guns in 2020 than any year in the history of the country before that, and that created a rise in gun violence in particular in lots and lots of cities across the country, including Philadelphia. So that was the year when gun violence rose. Other places, it has stabilized a little bit. Philadelphia is one of the cities where it hasn't, where violence has continued to rise in the year since.
Why did people feel the need to get guns or more guns during the pandemic? What was driving that, Patrick?
It's a good question. I mean, we all lived through it. There was a clear sense in 2020, particularly at the start of the pandemic, that everybody's on their own, that, you know, the government wasn't going to step in and help. That people had to deal with this crisis on their own. So there was the hardship that came with the pandemic, but then there was also the shutdown of public life, the shutdown of, you know, the institutions that bring us together, like schools and workplaces, and even parks and libraries and community centers. When all of these places shut down, when people retreat to their homes, there is this clear sense that we're all on our own And that changes the nature of public life and public space. I think that played a big role in pushing people to go out and try to find a means to just protect themselves. So the surge in gun ownership was really astounding. And we have very clear evidence that when there are more guns out on the streets, there's going to be not only more homicides, but more suicides, more gun accidents as well. So there's a clear link here. What rose was not crime generally. It was gun violence in particular.
Yeah. And Kendra, let me go back. You work with young people. Do they carry guns?
They carry guns. People are afraid. They say, you know, we're losing our friends every day. I'm seeing family members die in front of me, and I'd rather be caught with a gun, even if it's illegal, than without one. So it makes them feel like they need to carry it because they're unsafe.
And I mean, they feel as if they do it for protective reasons.
Absolutely.
And then when we see the gun violence, it's that sort of moment decision to use this firearm.
Absolutely. I mean, I think about how we have conversations with young people about whether they actually are safe carrying guns versus if it's just the way we feel. We may feel safer, but are guns actually protecting you from being killed? And we're seeing no, because people who are being killed also have guns on them.
I mean, you're having that conversation. How do you frame that for a young person so that gets them to think maybe twice about carrying a gun, but maybe that also makes them more vulnerable?
Yeah, it does make them more vulnerable. I mean, we know when you carry guns, even if it's legally, you will escalate situations by having a gun on you, but a lot of them just feel that they have to carry it. They cannot go anywhere without it. You know, they don't know what's going to happen, but I'd rather have it and possibly be able to save my life or shoot back at someone if I am being shot at, and they want to deal with those consequences.
Yeah. Right. Sammy, go ahead. I want you to weigh in on that.
I just want to hear a little bit about some of these conflicts. I understand a lot of them start as arguments and they just escalate so fast. You know, something that used to maybe be a fight is now a gunfight.
Yeah. So a lot of people are telling us, we've been running focus groups with young people up to age 26 who are affiliated with certain block gangs in the city. And a lot of what they tell us is that the arguments stem from like old school beefs back when they were in high school that have never gone away. So these things are escalating.
Well, and I wonder too whether social media then just amplifies that.
Yep, no, it absolutely does. People are creating fake pages. They are threatening people. Oh, if I see you, it's headshot. You might not even be knowing who is saying this to you. But people are getting tons of messages and, you know, dissing the dead. Oh, we killed this person. This group is associated with killing this person, and we're going to get you back. It's all of these things that are definitely amplified, specifically by Instagram.
Well, and picking up what I said to you earlier, Sammy, about just the impact on neighborhoods, and one can imagine sort of the sense of being traumatized. We talk about that in war zones where people are traumatized. There is PTSD because of the level of violence.
I would say so, given the conversations I've had with people either directly involved or just witnessing it. And, you know, I think when you're in a state where you feel frustrated, kind of abandoned, hopeless, you're going to be quicker to react in a violent way. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a lot of push for mental health services and conflict resolution services, just kind of coping mechanisms to try to help people process their feelings so they don't go right into something that can be harmful.
Patrick, let me get you back in on the conversation here. And I do want to talk about programs that do work or at least show some promise, but I also want to make sure that we understand the sort of totality of the problem that we're dealing with. And I was thinking, you know, no one is born a murderer. I mean, you know, babies are babies and they come into this world with all their innocence. So what creates this environment of violence?
That's exactly right. And extreme inequality creates the conditions for violence to emerge. So let me explain what that means in a little bit more depth. It's not just, you know, having rich and poor people. It's when communities have concentrated poverty. In the U.S., that has meant that resources have been siphoned away from those communities, both by the federal government, but also by state governments, as power has kind of shifted outside of central cities into suburban and exurban communities. the institutions in those neighborhoods start to wither away. And I mean everything from, you know, schools don't have the resources they need, to churches start to empty out a little bit, to just people move out if they can. And so what is left behind is communities. And it's not that it's poor people. It's that it's communities that don't have the basic investments in parks, in playgrounds, in libraries, in schools, in religious congregations that prop up a neighborhood, that prop up every neighborhood. And so when you lose those resources, when a community starts to empty out, it becomes vulnerable to violence. And then everyone within that community is affected by it. So those are the conditions that create concentrations of violence, like we see in Philadelphia, like we see in lots of places where there's extreme segregation, extreme disinvestment, and concentrated poverty.
And Kendra, picking up on that, when you talk to young people, do they have people in their lives that they can talk to? I mean, do they feel as if they are known and cared for?
So we survey a lot of young people about that specific question. Some of them feel like they don't have a lot of people to talk to. We often talk about how young people need more trusted adults. So they say, sometimes I may be able to talk to this person, but then sometimes not. And they're holding so much. They're holding so much trauma. They're feeling like they can't trust people. I know when James and I first started Yeah Philly, people were like, kids were like, why are you being so nice to us? Like, it took a while to build that trust. Why are you giving us food? You don't even know us. Why are you so nice to us? You don't know anything about us. And it took a while to talk to them about, this is the way you're supposed to be treated. These are the ways that adults should be talking to you and treating you.
And I got to say, I've been Kendra's center a couple of times, and it feels like a home.
It does,
like,
yeah.
It feels like a place
it's
where
like
there's
a family.
Love.
Like, it's a family.
And I can just tell that the kids that are there, they needed right. that.
But what they were saying to you, Kendra, initially was, you don't know me. Maybe I don't deserve this trust. Yeah,
absolutely. And I don't need to know you to know that you deserve to be loved and cared for and cared about.
Patrick, do you want to weigh in on that? And we're almost having a break here, but just the importance of relationships, of trusted relationships.
What we know is that when there are residents and local leaders and community organizations in a neighborhood that see it as their task to look out over the space and welcome everyone within it, make sure everybody feels taken care of, make sure no one falls through the cracks, then those places remain safe. And they also remain stronger neighborhoods. So we've never given the resources to groups like Kendra's group to play a prominent role, to play the central role in making sure that everyone stays safe within that neighborhood. We've never seen groups like Yeah Philly as the key to confronting violence, as a key to both dealing with violence, but also building stronger communities. And that is what has to shift at this point.
Well, we are going to take that short break and then get back to our conversation. We are talking about the crisis of gun violence here in Philadelphia with our guests Patrick Sharkey, Sammy Keola, and Kendra Vandewater. You can always join our conversation. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. We're looking for solutions to this problem. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with our guests about the gun crisis here in Philadelphia. Residents are scared and angry, particularly in neighborhoods hard hit by gun violence. We're talking about some of the root causes. We'll be talking more about solutions to curbing gun violence. And our guests are Patrick Sharkey. He's a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. Sammy Keola is gun violence prevention reporter for WHYY. And Kendra Vandewater is executive director and co-founder of Yeah Philly. Sammy, let me go back to you because there have been some calls. In fact, the president of city council for a while, Daryl Clark, talked about bringing back stop and frisk, something that was used here in the city. It has been, if not put on hiatus, certainly been not as omnipresent as it has been in the past. What's driving, I guess, these calls for sort of tougher approaches to gun violence?
I think this is really coming from a place of desperation, of people just not knowing what we can do in terms of solutions. And so they're looking for law and order. They feel like their communities have become lawless, like people can get away with anything. And some people want to police our way out of this. They want to see more officers on foot and on bike, more officers stopping people, checking them for firearms. But we know historically from evidence that stop and frisk does not recover a lot of firearms, and it disproportionately harms Black and brown residents. So we're going to see a lot of lashback if we move forward with that line of thinking. It's, I think, a really tough tension between police officers and community members, because you have some folks, largely older folks, who want to feel safer, and they think law enforcement will make them safer. And then you've got younger folks, and Kendra can speak to this, who are terrified. Right. They want, the last thing they want is more interaction with police officers. And so there's a real generational divide here.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Kendra. Yeah, speak to that, please.
I mean, I'm afraid of the police, too. I was beat by the police in Philadelphia, 22nd District, when I was 16, waiting for my mother to come pick me up. So things that happen when we say stop and frisk may work, when we know, research shows, it does not work. But also, it's fine to feel like you don't know what else to do, but we cannot just keep making up things to bring back. But also, stop and frisk has never gone away. People are still stop and frisked every single day. And if it is brought back, quote unquote, then even more people will continue to be subject to harassment and more police contact. That's negative.
Well, Patrick, you've written about this and about the impact of some of these get tough approaches to violent crime. Do they work? And if they work, is there some kind of after effect that really almost like sabotages them in the end?
Well, in New York, so I lived in New York for 10 or 11 years while stop and frisk was ended as a central tactic of the NYPD. And, Bill de Blasio ran on a platform of ending stop and frisk, and he did it. In New York, there were 700,000 stops that were documented every year. It went down to about 10,000 or so. So as Kendra says, I'm sure there were more stops than were officially reported, but there was a major change in the tactics of the NYPD. And what happened, even though, former Mayor Giuliani and Mayor Bloomberg and Police Commissioner Ray Kelly all said, okay, crime is going to explode. Violence kept falling when they ended this as a central tactic, and it fell to record lows. We have evidence that stop and frisk has harmful effects, and aggressive policing more generally has harmful effects on young people. There's really good evidence that it affects them in school. They carry the stress of being harassed by police in school. Now, so I want to be clear that that doesn't mean that all policing is negative. There's actually really good evidence, some evidence from Philadelphia, that when police are on foot patrol, when they are making efforts to get to know residents, it's effective. Okay, Jerry Ratcliffe has done some really rigorous research showing that. So it's not that all policing practices are harmful, but bringing back the most aggressive policing practices that have just created this resentment, this anger, this mistrust of the police is a terrible idea.
Well, Sammy, let me go to you. And we were talking actually before going on the air about you were on a drive around last night with some police around, was it the 20s?
Yeah, I was in the 24th district last night, so around Kensington.
So what did you observe?
Yeah, I actually was in a police car for 3 to 4 hours last night, and a lot of driving around, staying in the car, maybe rolling down the windows, asking people to move along, if they were, using drugs in most instances up there. Not much getting out of the car, maybe once or twice. And, I asked the officer I was with a little bit about this, and, he said it's a resource issue. They don't have the amount of officers they would need to get out and build community relationships. That was his take. And also that, there is some, and this didn't come directly from him, but I've heard from other law enforcement representatives that there's kind of a chilling effect that happened post George Floyd, that officers they're just kind of hesitant to interact with members of the community. And so there's something broke, right? A trust broke. And it's a question of do we need to rebuild it through community policing, and will that help us?
Well, let me toss that to you, Kendra.
Yeah, so I don't know how you are limited on resources that require talking and getting to know people. So I think that police definitely can resolve a lot of the issues just by how they communicate with people. We get so many complaints about how they're talked to, how they're called names. So police getting out and talking with people and getting to know would definitely be an easy and small start to building trust that, you know, historically it really wasn't there, but it was better. It was better even though it wasn't there. Yeah, better than now. And people are afraid of the police. So we definitely have a long ways to go. I know I used to do ride-alongs all of the time here. And the officers I were with was great. I was with them for 8-9 hours. You know, he talked to people all day. And he's one of the officers that people always say, oh, yeah, that's my guy. I like him. So, yeah, we know there are good police officers out there. But the ones who are often patrolling are not the ones that are associated with community relations. And that has to change.
Sammy, are the police, are they afraid to get out of the car? Or are they just, I mean, you mentioned since George Floyd, it feels as if something is broken or has changed.
Yeah, I mean, the officer I was with last night definitely did roll down the windows and talk to people. You know, I think he was a long time officer and pretty tough. But, you know, when it came to should I stop this person, you know, take their, you know, search them, I think there's a hesitance to have those kind of close encounters because something can escalate, and you know no officer wants to be in a situation that could become violent in that way. So I think that's where the fear comes from. They don't want to be the next headline, and I think that it's just a fraught situation.
Yeah, I mean, Patrick, how do you build, sounds like, not just rebuild, but really build some kind of trusting relationship between the police and the community they are hired to preserve, you know, serve and protect?
Well, so we do have evidence from interventions, procedural justice interventions carried out with police officers, that it can be effective. It reduces use of force. It reduces negative interactions between residents and officers. So there are things that we can do. It's really difficult with a giant institution like the Philadelphia Police Department or the NYPD to kind of implement these interventions and really change the culture of the institution on a large scale. But we definitely can make progress. And there are lots of police forces that have made substantial progress. What I would say is that the police are going to have to be a part of this solution, and the primary reason is because there are so many guns in circulation. So we just mm-hmm. don't have other groups that are trained and well-equipped to handle a situation when a gun is involved. There's some groups that are getting better, and violence interruption programs are certainly part of that solution, but still law enforcement is the primary institution to deal with incidents where a gun's involved. So police are going to have to play a role, but it really has to be a new style of policing, and their central task has to be to rebuild trust.
And to figure out how to de-escalate. Sammy, you wanted to add something, and then Patrick, I want to go back
to you. Yeah, just a quick clarifying point here. I think law enforcement does have a role in getting firearms off of the streets, but it can't be like a mass approach where we go after anybody who might have a gun. It's got to be more targeted, and I think that's something law enforcement is trying to get better at, kind of using social media and other intel to, you know, see if they can find folks that they know are engaged in violence and, you know, go and address those folks instead of mm-hmm. causing potential harm to a whole neighborhood. Yeah.
I mean, I've been doing this show for decades now, and I remember, you know, have done interviews with police commissioners and community activists when there was community policing, and then we tried sort of targeted, focused on people that seemed at greatest risk for some kind of violence. Patrick, if I can go back to you, why don't we know what works when it comes to gun violence?
Yeah, I think we actually have a pretty good idea of what works. You know, so violence fell by half from the 1990s through the mid-2010s, And it fell quite a bit in Philadelphia. Philadelphia never got down to the rates in New York and L.A., but this was a period of substantial progress. And I think we have to keep that in mind, that, you know, the indicators like gun ownership was falling all the way through the mid-2010s. Gun deaths were falling. Lots of interventions in different places were working. And then things slowly unraveled. And so I think that pointing back to that history actually gives us some hope, because lots of things that we're doing, investing in community organizations, asking them to play a more central role in making their communities safer, changing the style of policing, there was actually a substantial amount of progress that was made. It fell apart in 2020 in cities all over the country, and I think there are reasons why it fell apart, but I don't think we should forget the progress that was made, even if it was imperfect, even if it came with a lot of costs that are difficult to reconcile right now. I still think we need to be aware that a lot of the interventions that were tried over time have actually been really effective.
You want to speak to that, Kendra?
Yeah, I mean, I think investing directly in people and communities, as Patrick says too, is a huge part of gun violence. And I know there's an epidemiologist. He studied about 13,000 cases where there were homicides and mass shootings. But also, he had said across the country that people who lived in places that were redlined back from the 1930s in communities that are poor had like a 27% increased chance of dying by gun violence. So that is big. So if we're just talking about investment, that is a huge thing. And that's what we need to do. That's what EF Philly does. I know before we got to our space in the community, people were like, oh, you help criminals, you know, we can't have that, and people already die here every day. Since we've been there, where we are in West Philly, there have been no murders, no shootings on that corner, because that is what we do. We've built trust with a community to where they know and respect what we do, and they take it somewhere else.
I think there is so much promise in this idea of kind of taking back the village in your area. You know, I've seen other neighborhoods where there, like, a corner becomes almost a safe space, like the area around the House of Umoja in West Philly. Yep. That, you know, they keep things clean around there. You know, neighbors are around. They're active, busy streets. Grays Ferry is working on greening their vacant lots. That's also been shown to reduce crime. But when I see it, it's at the hands of the people who live there. It's their sweat. It's their time. And it's their funding. They're scrapping it together.
Well, let me toss something back at you, Sammy, because the city has earmarked something like a little more than $200 million for some kind of investment in community programs. They seem to be deciding to invest most of that money into some long-term solutions, 5, 10, 15 years, and some degree in some short-term solutions. But how do you see what the city is saying through these investments?
Yeah, so about 71% of the funding is going toward what they call prevention and transformation funding. So that's the money that they're saying it's going to have a payoff in the long term. And I've gone to some of these programs. There are a lot of, you know, after school programs for kids, job programs, and that is all good stuff. But it's really hard to tell if these are the people that would end up being perpetrators of violence down the line. It doesn't feel very targeted.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, do they have data? I mean, do they have something to work with?
So, no, not yet. There hasn't really been thorough evaluation of how nonprofits are using this funding. And that's a criticism I hear a lot. It's like, okay, so we keep doing these rounds of funding, but what's been the impact? And I think people think it's not a direct impact. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, a lot of people say it's a yes and. We need to do that, and we need to fund intervention programs, which are the immediate, you know, effective in the next couple of years. These are things like violence interrupter programs, group violence intervention, like really targeting the people that are currently causing or at risk for causing harm. And those are programs that we've seen a lot of calls to put more funding into, because those have been shown to work in other parts of the country, but we're just not really really supporting them here.
Well, let me pick up on that, Patrick, and go back to you. I remember years ago, Boston, the city of Boston decided to do just that, which was to focus on those people considered to be high risk and just, you know, go at them with carrots and sticks. And they got good results, as I recall. And yet you hear about these programs and they're tried for a couple of years and then they kind of dissipate and fall away. What do we do to sort of make sure that, that whatever works is funded and funded in the long term?
So we have lots of examples. In Boston, you know, this new program, Ready Chicago, run by the Heartland Alliance, which is targeting people who are at the highest risk of being engaged with violence, is showing promising results. In Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Horticultural Society ran a abandoned lot greening program that John McDonald and Charles Brannis and Eugenia South and others evaluated that showed this enormous reduction in shootings around the buildings and the areas that were redesigned. These were abandoned lots that were redesigned. And so the evidence base is actually overwhelmingly strong. People don't believe this, but you know, this is not like a story about how I want the world to work. This is a story that is driven by incredibly rigorous and strong evidence showing that when you invest in residents and community organizations that have a direct stake in making sure everybody in their community stays safe, they are enormously effective in doing so, incredibly effective. We have just never seen these groups as the central actors in the effort to build stronger neighborhoods, to make every single neighborhood safe. So the resources they get mean that the programs are fighting for every dollar, trying to survive, instead of kind of being the dominant actors who are responsible for making sure everybody's safe, everybody is healthy, everybody's doing well, and everybody's welcomed in their community.
Well, we need to take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about the crisis of gun violence here in Philadelphia and the fact that there are solutions to curb this level of violence. Talking with Patrick Sharkey from Princeton University, Sammy Keola, gun violence prevention reporter for WHYY, and Kendra Vandewater, executive director and co-founder of Yef Philly. You can join us. Email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, again talking with our guest today on the show about the crisis of gun violence here in Philadelphia. We're also talking about possible solutions, programs, and approaches that have proved to be effective. Again, talking with Patrick Sharkey, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, Sammy Keola, gun violence prevention reporter for WHYY, and Kendra Vandewater, executive director and co-founder of Yef Philly, working with young people to reduce gun violence. Kendra, you were talking off the air. I'm going to make you do it on the air about the importance of coordination. Here we are in this, you know, big city in Philadelphia. You've got a lot of stakeholders. And what you were saying off the air was that we don't have enough coordination between people that, that care about this issue.
We absolutely don't. I think about the Chicago model, the Ready model that people are talking about and bringing to Philly. And they have, you know, the crime lab and the police department, plus the universities working together and the community groups. Here, it may be the city institutions working with law enforcement for certain interventions, but they oftentimes don't include the community. So if we know that the community doesn't trust the city, or that they're saying the resources are limited for people to go to, these things are not going to work. So we can bring whatever program we want to Philadelphia, but if there is no coordination and transparency and trust, it's not going to work.
Yeah. Patrick, can you weigh in on that? And then Sam, I want to get you. I mean, how important is it that there be cooperation and coordination?
Essential. It's got to be the city government, the state government, the police department, community organizations, and residents who are all working together toward a common goal of not just reducing violence, but also building stronger neighborhoods. And in the cities where that has not happened over time, those were the exceptions. So violence fell everywhere in the 1990s, except for a few cities. And you know, just descriptively, when I looked at those cities, those places where the police department had corruption issues, or the mayor, you know, went to jail for corruption, or there was no communication, there was dysfunction. So those primarily those three groups, the city government, the police department, and community organizations, if they're all working together, then the city has a much better chance of collectively confronting the problem.
Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, I'm glad that Patrick mentioned that lack of communication. And Kendra was talking about accountability. I mean, I think that's what's missing. There has been a roadmap for safer communities that the city created for Philadelphia since 2019. And people want to know, well, what happened with it? And the city put together these listening sessions to invite the community in to create an open channel, but they really didn't give a lot of updates. They really didn't give a lot of, here's what we've done, here's the impact. And instead they asked people for feedback, like, what do you want to see? And, you know, listening is great, but then those people left the meeting and they said, well, now what happens? Now What's the action? What is the city going to do with my feedback? Absolutely. And so I think until we have kind of that accountability and that report back, it's going to be very hard for people living in war zones, like Kendra said, to want to engage and to really feel like they're being invested in.
I mean, that's basic communication, Kendra.
Yeah, basic communication, transparency, and also understanding that funding tied to these things cannot be so restricted. The way we spend our money, our budget is almost $2 million. We're very new. Most of our money is unrestricted, and that's why we give so much of it to people directly, because oftentimes traditional funding does not allow you to do that. So we have to change the way we say this funding helps people, because it makes a huge difference.
Let me get Steve to join our conversation. And Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Everything, all the things that you people are saying is true. You know, all those things that you're suggesting, the programs, all that is fine. But the thing that doesn't be said, that should be said enough, for example, we're having global warming problems and things like that. So the government are forcing car companies and everything to start making electric cars. So there was a time when television went off the air at 12 midnight. There was a time when certain languages and certain things wasn't allowed to be put across the air. All this violence and stuff that's on television, all these different video games, all this violence. I'm asking intelligent people,
sure,
do you guys not think that that is a contribution to the problem? And if so, then why don't we address it to the people who are putting that stuff out?
Fair enough.
Children can see.
No,
adults can see.
I hear you, Steve, and I appreciate the call. And actually, Patrick, let me toss that first to you. Would that reduce gun violence?
Well, I think, you know, reframing the point, and it's an important point, you know, when violence is seen as kind of the answer to the problems that a society is facing, whether it's like we're dealing with COVID, okay, retreat to your homes and get yourself armed. You know, that's a message that's being sent across the government, across media. And so there is, you know, there's value in the point that the caller made. And I think it's very real to think about what message are politicians sending with their social policy, with their responses to a situation like COVID. To what degree do we accept violence as a solution, as opposed to sending out messages of, okay, let's come together, let's solve this problem of COVID-19, let's solve this problem of climate change, let's solve this problem of rising suicide, the opioid epidemic, rising gun violence, and let's do it collectively.
Well, Kendra, and I think Steve is getting to the point about where the worrisome point that if violence becomes normalized, then we have to live with a certain level of violence.
Yeah, I mean, it's normalized now, I think, and it's glorified. We glorify violence in everything we do as a society. Video games, like the caller said, the music we listen to all day, every day, the things they talk about, the videos and movies that we watch, they all glorify violence, retaliation, vigilante justice, all of these things that make it seem like it's a cool thing to do. And we cannot say, you know, we want to intervene in these things, but also all of our radios and news and media, even the way we report about gun violence in this city and how we talk about it is terrible. It's glorified. And then we're scaring people into say, oh, another violent night in Philadelphia. We know these things are happening, but the way it's talked about is it should be changed.
Well, and that's the ball is in your court, Sammy. Kayola, gun violence prevention reporter at WHYY.
Yeah, I would love to make like a quick plea to any journalists who are listening here that covering shootings, covering episodic violence, I don't think it helps. I think it makes things worse. I've heard people tell me that they are traumatized by the news, that it increases the cycle of fear, that it makes it feel normal. And that's why I've tried to focus on solutions only, you know, to only tell stories that move the conversation forward in some way. But it's not the norm in media, and I think it should be.
Patrick, you wrote a piece recently about the impact of like the mass shooting in Uvalde, Texas, and how long that sort of lasts in people's consciousness. I think you came up with 4 days. For 4 days, we think about that, and then it begins to disappear. Are we in danger of deciding we're going to live with this violence because it's the normal course of life?
What happens is violence has a momentum of its own. When there are more shootings, then more kids walk through the streets and think, okay, maybe I should walk around with a gun. Maybe they think I should act first instead of waiting to see how this interaction is going to go. And so when you're in a system where violence is rising, it can be this cascading process where it spreads through networks and it makes everyone more quick to act. And that's the biggest challenge. So even if we intervene now, violence has a momentum, and we have to stop that momentum with interventions because there's a virtuous cycle as well. When violence starts to fall, everyone becomes less likely to carry a weapon, becomes less likely to act first. So violence can fall very quickly as well.
Here's a tweet from David Kendra. I'll put it to you. He says, in Philadelphia, distress and dysfunction in parents leads to emotional distress in children even before first grade, resulting in difficulty in school. You talked about toxic stress. Kids who succeed in school are less often shooters. Help parents, help families, help children starting from birth.
We have to. The families that we work with are struggling. They need help. Even the things that we do with our smaller budget, we're helping with home repairs and furniture and food and all of these things that you obviously need to not just live but thrive. And a lot of kids that come to us do not have these things. They're living in houses that people should not be living in. So we're thinking about how, you know, school attendance and truancy. But if I live the way I'm living in this house that's horrible and I shouldn't be able to live in it, how am I going to focus in school? If I don't have food at home to eat, how am I going to focus in school? So all of these things definitely correlate to violence and stress and trauma, and we have to start addressing them.
Sammy, as you said, your beat is what works, you know, what can prevent violence. Is there a kind of, we've sort of touched on it, but is there a kind of a program that has not doesn't just show promise, but really shows results?
Ooh, such a good question.
I mean, you know, and I know, I mean,
it is hard. I mean, hard. I think yes. A lot of the programs that I've talked to, they're pretty small scale, and they're not necessarily able to track in numbers that what they're doing has immediate impact. But, you know, if you talk to the people that use the programs, they'll say, yeah, this turned my life around. Yeah. Or, yeah, this taught me how to, you know, mentor my kid better. Or this, you know, I'm going to be covering, a fathership workshop next week for young dads. You know, and I think any time that you can really invest in individual people as whole people and ask them what they need to stay safe and healthy and be successful, that it does have an impact. It's just, it's kind of a difficult to track impact. So, you know, I can't snap my fingers right now and tell you I found something that like, this is the thing that works.
Exactly.
But I think like Patrick said, it's putting it all together. Additionally, around these evidence-based intervention programs, I'm excited to see what the READI program is going to do here in Philadelphia.
That's R-E-A-D-I.
And it's a combination of, you know, casework, housing services, job services, mental health services. There are going to be 100 individuals in Philadelphia who are going to be able to access this program. They're going to be specifically chosen in coordination with community groups. In Chicago, it was shown that program participants were 20% less likely to get shot than those that did not participate. And so, you know, it's long overdue. It's not starting until January at this point, I'm told. But yeah, we'll see.
Yeah,
we have to do those things. I mean, I think about, so our program, we have an intensive violent crime initiative, which is almost 2 years old. It's about to be evaluated by Temple. We're about to put out all of our statistics soon. But we had a database built to collect everything we need to collect. And it shows that there were 65 young people in this program with violent charges, with active cases. They've been in the system for years, but we have a 72% success rate to the term of even just they haven't been rearrested. They've been in the system most of their lives and they were not rearrested because they're receiving jobs and money, and not just jobs and money, but reducing the barriers to get these things. We often talk about jobs and all these things, but we need vital documents. They need groceries. They need money right now. They need all of these things now instead of waiting and having to be referred elsewhere.
Here's an email from Susan Kinder. I want to toss this back to you. Does the attitude that someone who helps the community by sharing information with the police seen as a quote-unquote rat, does that still exist? How can police help if folks who know what's going on won't help?
It absolutely exists. The term rat is specifically for people who are engaged in street violence. To us, it's not for citizens in the community, your grandmother who calls the police. But if we do not have trust with the police and there is no incentive for people to do good and they're going to receive a consequence or jail regardless of what they do, why would people give information to the police? There has to be a change in how we deal with these issues.
Patrick, Philadelphia is the largest poor city in the country, and there are these experiments, kind of a universal basic income of actually giving families enough money so that they, if they're not out of poverty, they're not in deep poverty. Does that help to reduce gun violence or violence?
I think it can help. I mean, I think the core issue is when there are communities where the institutions don't work, where families aren't able to spend the time to get to know their neighbors, to get to know, you know, their children's friends, parents. Those kinds of connections are what lead people to go out in a public space and make sure that everybody's doing okay. Having the basic necessities taken care of, like stable housing, like a basic income, going to a decent school, makes all that possible. Mm-hmm. So without those basic needs being taken care of, you can't expect parents to go out and to try to look out for their neighbors. That's really hard to do when you don't have stable housing and stable family life.
Here's a comment from Mary Ells. I'll put this to you, Sammy. We need to hold our city officials accountable for the violence. Kenny Clark and Krasner, based on your interviews with people on the street, are these the people responsible? And maybe we should put outlaw in there as well, the police commissioner?
People are definitely looking to those in power in our city to solve this. You know, the worse it gets, the angrier people get. You know, it's going to be a huge issue leading up to the next mayoral election. I can already tell you it's going to be the number one thing that people talk about. And I think it's a matter of promises that are made, making sure they're followed up on. Right. And that is part of what I want to do in journalism is, you know, be something of a watchdog and check in on things that were promised to see if they come through, because I think that's the only way that you build trust with people affected by this problem. So, yeah. And I think people notice that lack of coordination that Kendra mentioned. People know that higher ups are not working together.
Right. 10 seconds, if you don't mind.
10 seconds. We cannot blame one person for gun violence. We cannot. People, this is saying that people are not being locked up. That is not true. We have to increase our solve rate for homicides and shootings and all of these things.
Well, we also have to leave it there. My thanks to all three of you for joining us on Radio Times. Kendra Vandenwater, thank you for coming in. Sammy Keola, thank you for coming into our studios as well. And Patrick Sharkey, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well on this important issue.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.